My name's Dave Emery, and in this half-hour segment, we're going to touch on a subject that I've ruminated about at some length for the last 6 or 7 years or so, ever since the Soviet Union began to look wobbly, and then once it collapsed and dissolved. I have warned about the distinct possibility, I think it's a probability, that at some point either Russia and or many of the former constituent republics of the Soviet Union would go fascist. And I envision at some point a fascist Soviet Union or a fascist Russia hooking up with a fascist European Union under German domination, and that is a truly scary scenario. It may be that if Russia does go fascist or quasi-fascist, its extreme nationalism will keep it from aligning itself with Germany, an historical enemy. On the other hand, there are already some very strong connections between fascist elements in Russia and fascist elements in Germany, so we will see what happens. Both countries maintain, in Germany under the surface and in Russia barely beneath the surface, a strongly anti-American viewpoint, and a viewpoint that could very easily translate into policy. And in terms of German trade and espionage policy, it already is. My ruminations and warnings about the possibility of Russia going fascist were first sounded in RFA 37, How the United States Lost the Second World War, a massive archive show done over 13 weeks from July through October of 1992. Most recently, I repeated some of my warnings about Russian fascism in a program entitled A Look at Global Fascism, which examined fascism not only in the former Ukraine, but in some of the Baltic republics, as well as in Russia. Some of my ruminations are to be found, are to be found as echoed, in an article that appeared in The Economist's issue of July 11th, of 1998. Research credit on this goes to a member of the listening audience. Once again, from The Economist magazine of July 11th of 1998, we have the following story. It's entitled, Russia's Crisis, Could It Lead to Fascism? This is Dateline Moscow, and it reads as follows. And I'm going to read, time permitting, the entire article into the record. This, again, bear in mind, was written in July of 1998. Some of the economic tribulations of Russia have borne out some of the ruminations contained in this article to a considerable extent. Again, from The Economist of 7/11/98, Russia's crisis, could it lead to fascism? This reads, even by Russian standards, it's been a frightening and sometimes bizarre few weeks. The ruble is beyond on the edge of a precipice. Short-term interest rates, just 21% last autumn, shot up to 150% last month before coming down to 60%. They have again climbed back to 80%. If the ruble crashes, economic and quite possibly political catastrophe beckons. Instead of pottering around their weekend dashes and bathing in muddy pools, their usual summer pastimes, intelligent Muscovites are talking seriously for the first time in 5 years about a financial and political crisis that may be settled only by force of arms. Russian investors are close to panic. Russia's notorious tycoons, the so-called oligarchs who control fat swaths of the economy and send much of their assets, asset-stripped profits abroad rather than reinvesting them at home, have been fighting among themselves and with Mr. Yeltsin. Instead of propping up the status quo as they once did, they seem to be challenging it. Russia's four-month-old government, under an inexperienced 35-year-old Sergei Kiryenko, is fighting against a Duma, the country's lower house of parliament, that is loath to enact the necessarily painful reforms that would hurt an already bitter and exhausted populace. Mr. Kiryenko's team is gasping for survival before it has barely got going. And skipping down in the article, against this nerve-wracking backdrop and the dire effects of falling oil prices, Mr. Kiryenko's government, actually, let me fill in this particular section here rather than skipping ahead. This last sentence again before I took the break. Mr. Kiryenko's team is gasping for survival before it has barely got going. Things may start coming to a head next week when the communist-dominated parliament holds its final session before the summer holiday. Either Mr. Yeltsin or his parliamentary critics or both may decide that the time has come for a real battle for control of the country. Spurring Mr. Kiryenko on is dread of an abrupt devaluation which could lead to a collapse of confidence in the economy, not only among foreign investors, but among Russian citizens. I would add that that has since pretty much taken place. Continuing, This would spell doom for banking system. This would spell doom for the banking system on which much of Moscow's superficial prosperity is based, bring down the Kiryenko government, and, as one American diplomat put it, quote, signal the end of liberal Russia, unquote. The stock market, which has slumped by more than 60% since the new year, would fall even faster and further. Import-dependent Russians, poor as most of them already are, would become still poorer. The central bank would have to print money. Inflation, which has been more or less under control at an annual rate of about 10% at last count, would rocket. Extra-parliamentary revolt, egged on by Russia's many angry nostalgists from the Soviet era and perhaps endorsed by surly generals, cannot be ruled out. By the way, I would add that if fascism were something closely resembling it does come to Russia, it may very well come about through what is known as the Red-Brown Alliance. There has come in the post-Soviet period a strange coupling of bedfellows on the Russian political scene. Many hardline communists of the old Stalinist variety and many outright fascists have found common ground, both in terms of their campaigning against the dire conditions that currently obtain in Russia, also on a nationalist and to a considerable extent and growing extent anti-Semitic platform. That strange mixture of diehard communists and outright fascists, the aforementioned Red-Brown Alliance, is something that is discussed at a considerable length on the Russian political scene and may very well wind up bringing fascism or something closely resembling it to Russia. Continuing. The only factor shoring up the ruble is the widespread assumption that the United States and other Western governments will come up with a rescue package of at least $15 billion by next month. That belief was strengthened this week when the government said an agreement in principle with the IMF should be made within the next few days, and President Bill Clinton said he would come to Moscow in September. By the way, I would add that has already taken place, of course, as I speak, in early December of 1998. Continuing. Against this nerve-wracking backdrop and the dire effects of falling oil prices, Mr. Kiryenko's government has been struggling to do the right things. A vital new tax code is grinding its way through a recalcitrant parliament. A new tax collecting boss, Boris Fedorov, has been making creative mayhem by threatening to arrest the heads of Russia's largest companies if they do not pay their dues. On July 2nd, it was announced that the assets of Russia's biggest company, the gas monopoly Gazprom, which provides the country with almost a quarter of its tax revenue, but should pay still more, had been seized. A few hours later, a deal had apparently been done, and the confiscation order rescinded. Presumably, though the figures are already being disputed, a bit more money from Gazprom has been extracted. But the government needs a lot more to bolster its credibility. For one thing, millions of workers, including teachers, coal miners, and soldiers, have not been paid, sometimes for more than a year, despite Mr. Yeltsin's promises that they would be. The breezy idea that these millions can survive on factory handouts, barter, and moonlighting is misplaced. It is a mystery how many of them survive at all. In fact, many do not. Beggary, penury, crime, alcoholism, stress, the horrible novelty of unemployment, now 9% according to the International Labor Organization, and a male life expectancy of 58 years, all help to keep the anger bubbling. An array of provincial towns, the ancient city of Kosroma near Moscow and Petropavlovsk, the capital of Kamchatka in the Far East, to name but two, have been deprived of electricity or gas as a result of unpaid bills. Vladivostok has ground to a halt. That, by the way, is a port on the Pacific coast, the northern Pacific coast of Russia. Continuing. Pacific port of Russia. If the taxmen get nastier, such austerity will worsen. Imagine what it will be like when the winter draws in. Yet at the same time, it's hard to see the government fulfilling its latest pledge to cut spending while paying off all those arrears. However fine Mr. Kiryenko's intentions, the country is seething with resentment. It will seethe even more if and when reforms begin to bite, especially if a recently enacted bankruptcy law begins to take effect. While misery is nothing new, there is an atmosphere of chaos and trepidation that gives hope to both extremes of the political spectrum. By the way, that would be communist and extreme nationalist or fascist, although, as I noted earlier, the Red-Brown Alliance, a strange mixture of political bedfellows, has seen an element of commonality develop between those two elements. Continuing. Other strange happenings in the past few weeks have given politics an unusually febrile air. A few weeks ago, the country's head of statistics was arrested on bribery charges, presumably on suspicion of helping companies to pay less tax. Last week, the finance minister, fretting about the prospect of a ruble devaluation, was flatly contradicted by the central bank governor, who said that no such thing would happen. Then, with negotiations just starting with the IMF for an emergency stabilization fund to rescue the ruble, the feebleness of the government was undermined when Mr. Kiryenko felt obliged to call in Anatoly Chubais as Russia's chief negotiator, even though he had been unceremoniously sacked when the new prime minister was appointed. A few days ago, just to give the atmosphere a still more lurid flavor, Lev Rokhlin, R-O-K-H-L-I-N, perhaps Russia's most popular general and almost the only one to emerge from the war in Chechnya with any credit, was found murdered in his dacha outside Moscow. By the way, dacha, D-A-C-H-A, is the Russian word for small summer homes that Russian professionals own. Continuing about the murder of Lev Rokhlin, his wife was charged. Naturally, a host of media reports are suggesting foul play on high. The general joined parliament on a broadly pro-government ticket, but moved into open opposition after denouncing the scurvy treatment of the army. He then set up a political movement that was fiercely opposed to Mr. Yeltsin and to proposed cuts, especially in the army. His funeral on July 7th turned into a rowdy, anti-government demonstration by 10,000 people. Other present and past soldiers, not least Alexander Lebed, L-E-B-E-D, a populist ex-general who came in third in the last presidential election in 1996 and helped swing the result Mr. Yeltsin's way by backing him in the runoff, are mouthing off even more volubly against the government. Another plausible general, Andrei Nikolaev, a former head of Russia's border service, has set up his own political party, with a view, some say, to becoming president in the next but one election in 2004. Other less salubrious and less serious generals, such as Albert Makashov, bluntly demanded the rule of an iron fist. Lowlier ex-soldiers, like Alexander Barkashov, who says he has 70,000 adherents but may have only 12,000, are out-and-out fascists, though they prefer the label National Socialist. By the way, it was Alexander Barkashov and his organization that I discussed in the aforementioned pair of half-hour segments entitled A Look at Global Fascism. We should note that Barkashov, an outright fascist, has considerable support in official Russian circles. Continuing. The rumbustious meetings they hold across the country are getting noticed. Speaking of Mr. Barkashov, one more time. The rumbustious meetings they hold across the country are getting noticed. Last week, Mr. Yeltsin warned grimly of a rising tide of fascism. I'm going to interrupt this particular article, again from The Economist of July 11th of 1998, entitled Russia's Crisis, Could It Lead to Fascism? And I'm going to read the text of Mr. Yeltsin's warning about the possibility of fascism or Nazism coming to Russia. By the way, research credit on this goes to a member of the listening audience who got this off of the internet. This is a Reuters story, Dateline Moscow, June 22nd. By the way, another listener researched the article from The Economist that I am in the process of reading from. This, again, is a Reuters story that was downloaded from the internet by a member of the listening audience and emailed to me. This is Dateline Moscow, June 22nd. It's headlined, Yeltsin urges halt to neo-Nazism in Russia. President Boris Yeltsin marked the 57th anniversary of Nazi Germany's invasion of the Soviet Union during World War II and said on Monday neo-Nazism is a growing threat in Russia and its spread must be halted. Quote, I am worried that far from everyone feels how real the threat of extremism is in Russia, Yeltsin said in a radio nationwide address, continuing the quote, but it is there and this is very dangerous. Those obsessed with the ideas of national supremacy and anti-Semitism should ask themselves whether they realize what they are doing. Will the Russians allow the most fearful ideology ever known to mankind to take root on our soil? More than 25 million, unquote, by the way, more than 25 million Soviet citizens were killed in World War II. Russia has traditionally considered itself immune from Nazism, but the hardships of economic reforms launched after the 1991 collapse of the Soviet Union and the lack of Western-style liberal traditions have created conditions for a considerable growth of radical groups, including neo-Nazis. Some of them, such as the extremist group Russian National Unity, have adopted symbols strongly reminiscent of the Nazi swastika. The foreign community in Moscow has been alarmed by a series of recent attacks on people of African and Asian origin. Yeltsin's press secretary, Sergei Yastrzemski, has said tough measures are needed to avert similar attacks in the future. Quote, "Half a century ago, it was our country which saved the world from Nazism. But it is in Russia where it is raising its head now, poisoning the youth," unquote, Yeltsin said. Again quoting, "Teenagers, enchanted by the military insignia, are trying on black uniforms," unquote, he added, referring to the uniforms of the dreaded Nazi SS security force. Yeltsin urged Russians to prevent the spread of neo-Nazism. Quote, "Our common duty to the memory of the victims of Nazism is not to let the plague of the 20th century be revived," he said. That again, a Reuters story downloaded off the internet and Dateline June 22nd of 1998. I would note that although I share Yeltsin's concerns, I would remind listeners of something I pointed out in RFA 36, the destabilization of the Soviet Union in Eastern Europe. Boris Yeltsin, before he became president of Russia, was very close to the Interregional Deputies Group, and that in turn was very close to the Free Congress Foundation and some elements of the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations contained within that. The liberation director for the Free Congress Foundation was Laszlo Pastor, a veteran of the Hungarian Arrow Cross that fought with Hitler in World War II, also very active in the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations, a renaming of the Committee of Subjugated Nations founded by Adolf Hitler in 1943, a consortium of Eastern European and Central European fascist groups that ultimately was renamed the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations and became a key element of what used to be known as the World Anti-Communist League. Back to the Economist article of 7/11/98, Russia's crisis, could it lead to fascism? Can the crisis end in a coup? That was the main headline on July 7th in Nevedomozhaya Gazeta, The Independent, an influential newspaper that often echoes the thoughts of Russia's most prominent oligarch, Boris Berezovsky, who controls it. It reported that a putsch, along the lines of the one that ousted Mikhail Gorbachev in August of 1991, is already being prepared by senior members of the security forces. The shlukai, S-L-O-O-K-H-I, a much-used Russian word meaning rumors, are flying. It would certainly be unwise to assume, as many specialists on Russia have, that Russian soldiers are unkeen to get involved in politics. Many usually sober commentators in Moscow now argue that a change of regime, not just of government, is in the offing. People at the extremes of politics, communists on the left, nationalists on the right, are starting to smell blood. Strikes in key sectors may spread. Cargo on the Trans-Siberian Railway is again being blocked. Coal miners in several areas have downed tools. Workers in oil and gas fields are threatening to follow suit. Many teachers have stopped teaching. Defense workers in the Far East, unpaid for a whole year, have given up. Are the army and police certain to obey the civilian powers if it means physically repressing, perhaps even shooting such strikers? It is unlikely. Russia has, of course, lived through a series of wrenching crises since the Soviet Union collapsed at the end of 1991. But in the ensuing action-packed 6 years, there were a number of steadying factors. For the first 18 months or so, Boris Yeltsin was buoyed by the popular hope that a prosperous new order would soon arise. Even his ruthless destruction in October of 1993 of a reform-wary parliament that was still largely a Soviet creation seemed, in many Russian eyes, justified by the creation of a new constitutional order that was ratified by popular vote. The trauma of economic disruption, the destruction of savings by inflation, the erosion of the cradle-to-grave welfare net, skimpy as much of it always was, the insiderish unfairness of much of the privatization of the state, all seemed, admittedly to a steadily dwindling constituency, worth the pain so long as the final result was going to be prosperity. Another stabilizer was Viktor Chernomyrdin, prime minister for 5 years until his sacking in March. By avoiding most of the hardest choices and making compromises where he could, he helped keep the communist nationalist bloc in the Duma at bay. By the way, that's the red-brown alliance that I alluded to earlier. Continuing. Anyone, including these reds and browns, could buy into the party of power, unquote, if he wanted a bit of clout or a business. Most important, the oligarchs also had an interest in keeping things quiet. Hence their bankrolling of Mr. Yeltsin's re-election, with their media put at his and usually the government's disposal. The Duma huffed and puffed, but softened by bribes and threats, it invariably stepped back from confrontation. Regional governors, who make up the upper house of parliament and have been gaining power and economic independence, also generally cooperated with the Kremlin. Such calming factors may, however, be fading. Mr. Chernomyrdin is gone, victim of the cabinet reshuffle that brought Mr. Kiryenko to power. There is a growing sense that Mr. Yeltsin is a spent force. The oligarch's support for him is more conditional, short-term, and ambiguous. They are looking to a successor, and are divided over who that might be. In any case, the Yeltsin entourage is sending out ominously distinct signals that its man may, after all, run again, despite the Constitution, which sets 2 4-year terms as the limit, and contrary to the president's own recent denials that he might stay on. His aides say twistily that Mr. Yeltsin's first term does not count because it started under a Soviet and therefore now invalid constitution. Whether he runs or not, Mr. Yeltsin is yesterday's man. To be sure, during the current crisis, he had backed Mr. Kiryenko solidly. His courage, canniness, and occasional bursts of energy are still felt. But most of the time, his mental powers are as weak as his physical ones. He probably still, from time to time, goes on binges. He is a sick man with erratic judgment. Even if he occasionally overrides the Duma with sensible decrees, he rarely puts his reputation on the line to force reforms through, or lobbies the country or parliament assiduously enough to sell a policy that is unpopular. Although president, he does not lead. As for the regional governors, they too have changed. Rather than cooperate with the big man at the center, as Moscow is known, many of them prefer to go their own ways, keeping tax revenues for themselves, dealing with companies, even countries, off their own bats, generally edging away from Kremlin control, sometimes, but by no means always, to the benefit of their people. Local voters have kicked out quite a few pro-Yeltsin governors. If a new order arose, democratic or not, the regional bosses would be likely to play their own part in reshaping it. Skipping down, there are still more drastic possibilities. The chaos of the currency collapse could pave the way for some kind of creeping coup, constitutional or otherwise. Mr. Yeltsin, if he were still there, or a successor, might, along with a new Duma, be forced to hand extraordinary powers to some would-be savior, Mr. Lebed, perhaps. It would not be hard to imagine such a figure closing down democracy in the interests of order and anti-corruption. The army might be called in to help run the show. Whether a Latin American-style strongman would point the economy the right way is doubtful. From his new power base in Krasnoyarsk, where he recently became governor, Mr. Lebed last week noisily rejected Moscow's demands for economic cooperation. Even if an economic collapse is staved off, and Mr. Yeltsin hangs on for another 2 years, the prospects for his succession look bleak. Assuming the Constitutional Court and his own bodily constitution lets him run again, he will surely lose. To whom? Not probably to his two scariest rivals. Despite the Duma election victory, which Vladimir Zhirinovsky chalked up with 23% of the votes for the half of the Duma filled by party list in 1993, his openly neo-fascist lot have peaked. Likewise, Gennady Zhuganov, the communist leader, looks fated to lead the pack with the rock-solid constituency that should gain him one-fifth of votes in the first round of a presidential race, but still looks very likely to lose to virtually anyone in a runoff. The most hopeful candidate would be Boris Nemtsov, N-E-M-T-S-O-V, still only 38, the government reformer most likely to impress voters, though his appeal has diminished with power. If Mr. Yeltsin and enough of the oligarchs put their weight behind him, he would have a chance, but only a very slender one, of winning. Quite simply, most Russians are hostile to reform as they have known it. The front-runners at present, then, are Mr. Lebed and Yuri Luzhkov, L-U-Z-H-K-O-V, the mayor of Moscow, who is one of Russia's most brazen crony capitalists. It would be wrong to stick the label fascist on either man. Mr. Lebed's ideology is resolutely vague. Both would be nationalistic, Mr. Luzhkov in particular promising to make trouble for the Ukraine, among other places. Neither is likely to be a social or economic liberal, though Mr. Lebed's views on economics swing around, and Mr. Luzhkov is above all a wheeler-dealer. Neither would care much for the finer points of democracy. It has become something of a commonplace to say that Russia will never go back to what it was, to orthodox Soviet-style communism. True enough, though the chances of a communist presidency would be hugely enhanced if the party changed its name, as its cousins in Central Europe have done, disavowed much of its history, embraced a bit of free marketry, and had the nous to put a youthful person like Poland's president, Aleksander Kwasniewski, at its head. Fortunately for Russia's reformers, they have no such nous. Far more likely, however, if things continue to go sour, is that Russia will swing the other way. Not all the way to fascism, but towards something nearly as bad, a kind of extreme nationalism. Intensely prickly and pan-Slavic, anti-Semitic, hostile to foreigners beyond and within its boundaries, eager to reabsorb the Slav heartlands of Ukraine and Belarus within the Russian fold, eager to make the Baltic trio of countries as weak and jumpy as possible. This quasi-fascism would also, in economic terms, be protectionist, corporatist, and loath to privatize any more of Russia's ailing industry, or let people, certainly not foreigners, buy land. It would probably come to an arrangement with the mighty oligarchs, but their crony capitalism would be tightly dependent on the whims of the political powers that be. The armed forces and the successors to the KGB would be raised again to a position of special eminence within the state. The press and television would be corralled. Russia would become an angry place, neither democratic, nor prosperous, nor kind to its neighbors. It is a nightmarish scenario. And I would add that it remains to be seen exactly what happens in Russia. I would say that I think the definition of fascism that they're applying here is a rather narrow one. That last definition sounds perilously close to fascism to me. That article again from The Economist of 7/11/98, Russia's Crisis, Could It Lead to Fascism? And research credit on that goes to a member of the listening audience, and a tip of the hat to that member of the audience. All of the various tapes that I've done over the years, the archive documentary shows, the half-hour segments that I've done, the interviews, the weekly One Step Beyond shows, and tapes of many of the lectures that I've given are available from a tape duplication service. The name of that service is Spitfire. That's one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E. You can reach them by mail at P.O. Box 1179. That's P.O. Box 1179. That's in Ben Lomond, California, capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. Once again, Spitfire, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. The email address for Spitfire is spitfire@ix.netcom.com. That's spitfire@ix.netcom.com. There is a partial list of the various tapes available from Spitfire on the KFJC webpage. Point your web browser at www.kfjc.org. That's www.kfjc.org, and look in the public affairs section. People in other parts of the country can listen to the One Step Beyond show that I do from 7 to 10 p.m. Every Sunday night at 7 to 10 p.m. Pacific time, as well as 6 to 7 p.m. on Thursday evening. And you can listen to it at that website, www.kfjc.org. Listeners can also email me at kfjc. The email address is demory@kfjc.org. That's demory@kfjc.org. That concludes this segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.